You don't have sickness.
Yes, sir.
You don't either.
Yes, sir.
All Christians weren't persecuted till Nero. And that was in Rome, nowhere else. Anybody knows that? He had a falling out with the Pope. Isn't it amazing how history's been messed up? You want me to continue?
Yes,
sir. The commander-in-chief selected by the Emperor Claudius to carry out his edict was none other than the famous Aulus Plautius, called the Scipio of his day. He stands in Roman history as one of the most brilliant commanders and conquerors in her military record. He arrived in the area of Britain we now know as England A.D. 43, making his headquarters at Chichester. Plautius lost no time in sending his veteran legions into action, directing his campaign to the south against the Silurians, thus cutting off the powerful Brigantes in the remote north, who were the Yorkshire Celts. Both armies clashed with appalling violence, and in this first conflict, the Romans, probably underestimating the quality of their opponents, were forced to retreat. In the various battles that followed, to his surprise, the Roman general realized he was confronted with a military intelligence that matched his own, and an army of warriors, though greatly outnumbered, were undaunted and fought back with a fearless ferocity which had never before been encountered by the veteran soldiery of Rome. For the first time, the Romans found they were not opposing a race of people who could be terrorized by numbers or brutalities. To their dismay, as reported by Tacitus, they found the destruction of the British sacred altars increased their anger, making them blind to odds and circumstances. The more destructive and brutal the Roman persecution, the more determinedly did the Britons strike back. Where'd I get this bad bunch of cigars? I want to teach all night if necessary. I'll be here till Sunday, Lyra. I'm going to get a cigar that'll burn. I don't quit. You know that, don't you?
Yes,
At the onset, the British Silurian army was led by Guiderius, the elder brother of Arviragus, who was second in command. Guiderius had succeeded his father to the kingdom of the Silures. Arviragus, as prince, ruled over his dukedom of Cornwall. In the second battle with the Romans, Guiderius was killed in action. Arviragus succeeded his slain brother in command of the army into the kingdom of the Silures. At this time, the second branch of the Silurian kingdom, lying farther south in what now is Wales, had not entered the conflict. Caradoc, king of the Welsh Silures, was first cousin to Arviragus, a much older man and an experienced military leader. A few years before this record, his father, known as the good King Bran, had abdicated his throne voluntarily in favor of his son Caradoc. Bran, who had abdicated, father of Caradoc, was a deeply religious person and had resigned his kingship to become Archdruid of Siluria. He and his family had accepted the new faith, and some of the members of the family had been already converted and baptized by Joseph with the laying on of hands. But Bran and Caradoc had not received this final act of conversion. Now, as the conflict between Roman and Britain increased in vigor and territorial scope, Caradoc realized the seriousness of the situation, particularly since the death of his cousin Guiderius. It was agreed that a more concerted and determined military action was needed against the Romans. Arviragus, by necessity, was only substituting in command for his slain brother. It was the law among the British that the supreme leader of the army, especially when more than one clan was involved, could only be appointed by general acclamation of the people, the military council, and the archdruids. The election to such a command was known by the official title, as said earlier, of Fendragon, meaning commander-in-chief. By popular election, Caradoc, better known in history by the name the Romans gave him, Caractacus, was created Pendragon. Caractacus was a man of great vigor, intelligent, versed in the arts of politics and warfare. As is to be expected, being raised in a religious household, he had deep religious convictions. He had received his education chiefly in the British universities and partly at Rome. He was an able administrator of noble mien and outstanding stature. His countenance was described by Roman writers as bold and honorable. Such was the man who was elected Pendragon to conduct the war against the invading Romans. He began the continuation of the strife with all his natural energy. Out of this bitter conflict, and remember, it's his household, later to be paroled, having been captured through treachery by the Roman Emperor Claudius, with his daughter Gladys being adopted by Claudius, marrying a Roman senator, brother or half-brother of Paul the Apostle, that is, the household of faith for the Gentiles to which the Roman letter was delivered. And those names in Romans 16 carry all of this history behind them. Out of this bitter conflict, his outstanding military genius, his indomitable character and invincible courage carved for him an immortal name in history that was never to perish in British and Roman annals. Feared by the foe, it is said that Roman mothers used his name to quiet their children. His military merit won the unstinted admiration of the enemy, who named him, quote, the scourge of the Romans. I'd like to be named on my tombstone, if I live and die before Jesus comes, the scourge of the fundamentalist nuts. Historically, his achievements are well known, but not so well the reason for them. Modern historians, in dealing with the Roman invasions, completely ignore the reason for the great Roman invasion of Britain. Never once do these modern historians mention the Edict of Claudius or explain that it was a war of religious extermination designed to crush Christianity at its source. Evidently, they were totally ignorant of the true reason. They could easily have been enlightened by reading the Roman records of that time. They write off the 9 years of ceaseless warfare between Roman and Britain, led by Caractacus and Arviragus against the greatest Roman generals, as though it was of no significance. They give the impression that the British armies were driven like wild sheep before the Roman legions. Surely it takes but little imagination from even a casual perusal of this campaign to realize that it would not take 9 years for the Roman Empire to subdue opponents who were merely wild, painted barbarians. By this time, Rome had conquered all the world except Britain. They had defeated mighty armies skilled in warfare and led by brilliant kings and generals. The conquered nations they had enslaved in Africa, Asia, and Europe testified of their despotic brutality. The same Roman generals who accomplished these conquests led the Roman army in Britain and failed one after another. With such a far-flung empire to protect, the Roman emperors could not afford to keep their greatest army and best commanders in Britain for 9 years. Less could they afford the decimation of their veteran legions and useless combat. The enormous loss of lives on both sides, sustained in many battles in Britain, according to the records, were larger than the loss in most of the battles in World War I, World War II. Such losses, enumerated in the annals, do not indicate a leisurely Roman campaign in Britain. In some of the battles, several of the greatest Roman generals were engaged in conducting battle strategy at one time. This was an experience never before called for of Roman generalship. The Romans had met their match in military genius and in man-to-man combat, a warrior ferocity that outmatched their tough veterans. Oh. The fierce, fearless spirit of the British soldiery appalled the Romans. Their bravery and disdain of death shocked them. The great Agricola, engaged in the British campaign, stated it'd be no disgrace if he fell in battle among so brave a people. I better pray I keep this one going or we'll be here all night. This had to be more than a defense of the shores. Which could have been readily ended by coming to terms with the Romans. It was a battle against extermination of all the Britons held dear. On these fields, for Britain, the cross of Christ was unfurled. As given to Arviragus by St. Joseph, so all nations should see for the first time in military history. This alone proclaimed what the British were fighting for, defense of their new faith, Christianity, the gospel of Jesus, with the freedom it had given to all who believed in him. Caractacus is given official credit. I want to get to see how far it was to his speech. That's what I was doing. Caractacus is given official credit. How many people have read the Bible through in 62, 52, 62, 72, and 82 and just raced through Romans 16 and had no idea who these people were that were being named therein? Caractacus is given official credit as being the first general to lead a Christian army in battle in defense of the faith. As Pendragon of the British elected with him an open council, this is true. But it was Guiderius and Arviragus who led the first battle against the Romans. It was they who first stopped Aulus Plautius in his tracks. Guiderius was the first British king to fall for Christ. Before Caractacus was elected, Pendragon, the British battalions had marched toward the foe, flying the coat of arms bequeathed to Arviragus by Joseph on their battle standards and painted on their war shields, and this was long before St. George was born, and every Christian church in America unfurls that cross and don't even know where it came from. Or rather, unfurls that flag. How many of you knew? Huh? Boring you?
No, sir.
Doesn't matter, you're numb. Fearlessly, they met the full force of unconquered Rome and defeated them. This is the imperishable record of the valiant British in the Claudian 9-year war. Throughout the entire campaign, Arviragus fought as the right-hand man of the Pendragon, Caractacus, and for years after, when Caractacus no longer led the British forces against the plundering, murdering Romans, he conducted the conflict. Though the Romans destroyed every altar in their path, not once were they able to pierce through to their objective, the Isle of Avalon, the sanctuary of Christendom. Why didn't they just pray? Saint Joseph and his companions were never molested, nor was their shrine ever violated by Roman intrusion. No better picture can be obtained of the relentless manner in which this war was fought, with victory swinging from one side to the other, than by reading the reports of the foremost Roman writers, Tacitus, Martial, Juvenal, and others. The story chronicled by the pens of the enemy gives more substance to the truth than if it were written by the British. With ungrudging admiration, they tell how the Silurian warriors, led by Caractacus, Arviragus, and the archpriests, swept onward in irresistible waves over the bodies of their dead and dying comrades with a battling savagery that appalled the hardened, war-scarred veterans of the Roman legions. Their fierce outcries of defiance rang over the din and clash of sword and shield. For the first time, the Romans met women warriors fighting side by side with their men in righteous combat. Tacitus states that their long flowing flaxen hair and blazing blue eyes were a terrifying sight to behold. For the first time, the Roman soldiery heard the amazing model of the ancient Druidic priesthood transferred into a clarion Christian battle cry. The truth against the world, it translated to. No finer battle cry was ever employed with equal truth, and it's never died. It has lived through the ages, and today it is the motto of the Druidical order in Wales. Truly, the British stood alone against the world, fought alone, died alone. Remember the prophecy concerning Ephraim. She'd never be defeated in the place where she settled. Truly, the British stood alone against the world, fought alone, died alone, even as they did in the most hazardous early years of the last two world wars, battling for the great truth and the preservation of its principles of freedom in the name of their accepted Savior, Jesus Christ. Tacitus, the Roman historian, writing in the Claudian campaign that lasted for 9 years, except for one brief 6 months pause, dismally wrote that although Rome hurled at the British the greatest army in her history, it failed to prevail against the military genius of Caractacus and the reckless fierceness of the British warrior. Well, we've all been taught the Romans conquered the world. Many drawn battles were fought, and the famed legions of Rome frequently suffered defeat with terrible slaughter. On occasions when the British suffered reverses, Tacitus said, the fierce ardor of the British increased. Retreat, hell. Advance to the rear. After 2 years of ceaseless warfare, Claudius, recognizing the futility of the struggle and the terrible drainage on his finest legions, took advantage of a reverse against Caractacus at Brandon Camp, A.D. 45, to seek peace through an armistice. A six-month truce was declared in which Caractacus and Arviragus were invited to Rome to discuss the possibilities for peace. The facts that followed prove that Claudius went to great lengths to come to satisfactory terms with the obstinate British leaders. Hoping to clinch the peace, the Emperor Claudius offered to Arviragus in marriage his daughter Venus Julia. And amazing as it appears, they were married in Rome during the truce period, A.D. 45. Here we have a strange instance of a Christian British king becoming the son-in-law of the pagan Roman Emperor Claudius, who had sworn to exterminate Christianity and Britain. That's better than dynasty. Surely one is justified in asking, would the emperor of a nation, then the most powerful in the world, high in culture and intellectual pursuits, have sacrificed his natural daughter in marriage to the wife of a crude barbarian just for the sake of peace? Impossible. There had to be some other valid reason. And as we shall see, as time moves on, the unseen hand of God was writing the script. The circumstances refute the later pernicious propaganda of the Christian-hating Romans, who in their benighted prejudice sought to label their most noble foe barbarian. Inconceivable. This marriage was but the beginning of other similar strange circumstances that were swiftly to arise. They were to have a tremendous influence on the Christian movement in Rome, with the British dominating the entire scene. During the 6 months' truce, while Caractacus and Arviragus were in Rome discussing peace terms, and the latter was getting married, Aulus Plautius, the Roman commander, remained in Britain maintaining the truce on behalf of Rome. During this interval, another strange alliance took place in Britain. Gladys, Celtic for princess, the sister of the British warlord Caractacus, was united in marriage to the Roman commander-in-chief, Aulus Plautius. Again we witness the amazing spectacle of a member of the Silurian royal family, a Christian, married to a Roman pagan. Gladys had been personally converted by Joseph of Arimathea, together with her niece, Ergane, Guiderius, Arviragus, and other members of the British aristocracy. Getting thick. Like her father, the ex-king, Bran, and present arch-druid, she was devoutly religious, completing her religious instruction at Avalon and in association with those who came with Joseph of Arimathea. Considering all this, one is immediately intrigued by this unusual situation. It's made more exciting as we realize that her brother and husband were wartime opponents. The marriage of Gladys and Plautius is brought into the Roman limelight by Tacitus, the Roman historian, in his Annals, 1332. Not year, but volume 1332. Wherein he relates with humor the peculiar circumstances and results of a Roman trial in which Gladys, the wife of Plautius, is accused of being Christian. On her marriage, Gladys took the name of Pomponia, according to Roman custom, which was the name of the Plautian clan. Later, the name Graecina was added, so that she is therefore known as Pomponia Graecina Plautius. The added name was a distinctive academic honor conferred upon her in recognition of her extraordinary scholarship in Greek, a barbarian. I don't even know all this. As we shall see, it's too cold now. The truce fell through and the hostilities were resumed between the British and the Romans. Now they're all intermarried. Following the marriage of the Roman commander Aulus Plautius to the British princess, Gladys, it appears as though the Emperor Claudius distrusted leaving further operation of the war in Britain to Plautius. Smart idea. He recalled to Rome A.D. 47, Plautius, though honorably relieved of his command. Reference to these events and the trial of Gladys is well covered by Tacitus, as will be noted from the following quoted text. Pomponia Graecina, a woman of illustrious birth and the wife of Plautius, who on his return from Britain entered the city with the pomp of an ovation, was accused of embracing the rites of a foreign superstition. The matter was referred to the jurisdiction of her husband. Plautius, in conformity to ancient usage, called together a number of her relations, and in her presence sat in judgment on the conduct of his wife. He pronounced her innocent. From our point of view, the method of the trial provides a humorous situation. It was the custom of Roman law to give priority to the nobility to judge and settle any legal disputation where the family was concerned. Consequently, it was an order for Plautius to judge his wife. Next, we note that Pomponia is judged in the presence of her own relations, in-laws. All immediate members of the royal Silurian Christian household undoubtedly acted in her defense. It's quite certain that not much defense was needed. Plautius knew his wife Gladys was a Christian before he married her, as were all the immediate members of her family as well as her royal relatives. The fact they were married in Britain makes it certain the bond of holy matrimony was sealed by the priesthood of her Christian faith. Evidently, Plautius had a sympathetic leaning to the new faith, for we're later informed he also became a Christian. Viewed in the light of these circumstances, it was a foregone conclusion that Plautius would judge his wife's innocence, which he did. The Reverend C.C. Dobson, M.A., a keen student of Celtic Roman history, in his learned works goes into much detail covering this whole situation, pointing out that Tacitus refers to Pomponia as a woman of illustrious birth and an aristocrat. Her marriage to the Roman nobleman bears this out. Plautius certainly recognized her social situation to have been equal to his Roman dignity. That she was unusually talented as well as highly cultured is borne out by the honor of her Roman conferred title for her expertise in Greek. The Reverend Dobson writes, for 40 years, she was a leader of the best Roman society. A brilliant woman of wide cultural learning, she was a past scholar in classical literature and wrote a number of books of prose and poetry in Greek and Latin, as well as her native language, Cymric. Well, we'll go home tonight. That's a fine ash. Their home, Gladys and Plautius, was a meeting place for the talented. And they were to be intimately acquainted with the apostles Peter and Paul, as Gladys had been with Joseph, Lazarus, Mary Magdalene, the rest of the missionaries at Avalon. The Roman records state that when the Roman general Aulus Plautius was recalled to Rome, A.D. 47, we're getting awful close to Paul's writing of the letter to the Romans, he took his foreign wife with him. This statement clearly indicates that his wife was not Roman, and since Plautius was unmarried when he arrived in Britain, was never absent during the years of his command, his wife had to be British. Well, that's pretty simple. Gladys and Plautius remained in Britain almost 18 months after their marriage. The armistice had proved fruitless. The British leaders considered the peace... Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The British leaders considered the peace terms unsatisfactory. Why don't you give us this book and let us read it? Ain't got enough. Simple as that. Plus, it's expensive. The British leaders considered the peace terms unsatisfactory. Caractacus and Arviragus did not linger in Rome.
This is the end of Side 3. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side four. Thank you.